So thank you for having me, and thank you for coming. I wanted to just acknowledge two things. One, that so this session, sponsored by the API Caucus, Peter Block, hello, was actually put together by the National Task Force on Hepatitis B. And so this is the first time the National Task Force has come together to have a Hepatitis B session at APHA. And it's the first time that there is an actual Hepatitis B session at APHA. So I'm really proud of that. So I wanted to just make a little plug for that and a plug for the National Hepatitis B Task Force. So for anyone in the room who doesn't know about it, there is a task force on a national task force for Hepatitis B. And I encourage you all to join. If you go to it's hepbtaskforce.org, you can learn about us and come and join us. So I actually don't have any relationships disclosed. We had, believe it or not, we had two shares of stock that were part of our larger portfolio, and I finally told my husband to sell them because I was tired of having to disclose them all the time. So I have nothing to disclose. I'm going to take it back a little bit. We've been talking a lot about what's been happening and some of the public health campaigns and interventions have been. This is a little bit more researchy, and we're going to talk a little bit about undertreatment in hepatitis B. We talk a lot about the health disparities associated with hepatitis B and the lack of screening, lack of awareness, and lack of education. But it occurred to us a couple of years ago that there's also a lack of treatment for hepatitis B. And we once saw a number that said there's only 50,000 prescriptions a year written for chronic hepatitis B infection in the U.S., and that struck us. So at the Hepatitis B Foundation, we put together a working group, and we decided to look into it. And I'm going to talk about the findings today. The first thing we want to talk about is what are some of the outcomes of chronic hepatitis B infection. Probably most of you know what they are, but clearly chronic hepatitis B has some serious long-term outcomes, including cirrhosis, liver cancer, and death. And so it's really important that we look at chronic hepatitis B as a public health priority so that we can help prevent some of the long-term outcomes. And also, we need to recognize that management and treatment can play an important role in preventing some of those negative outcomes. We have, you know, we have a trifecta. We have a perfect situation. We have a chronic disease where you can actually prevent negative outcomes. And so from a public health perspective, that's great. The question is, are we doing what we need to do to put our tools into practice and make sure that things are happening? So clinical evidence indicates that you can decrease the risk of liver cancer and cirrhosis. You can prevent long-term outcomes with appropriate medical management and treatment. There are current professional practice guidelines out there put out by AASLD that talk about how you should manage and how you should treat patients who have chronic hepatitis B infection. And currently, it's estimated that about 25% of patients in the U.S. actually meet criteria for treatment. And that's something that's important to recognize, that not everybody who has chronic hepatitis B needs to take a medication for it. Not everybody has active disease. Not everybody will meet criteria for treatment, but about 25% of the infected population does at any given time. So the question is, are these people who meet the treatment guidelines getting the treatment that they need? So what we know is that approximately 50,000 prescriptions are written in the U.S. each year. And that represents a teeny tiny little proportion of the total chronically infected population. And interestingly enough, it also represents less than 10% of those who meet the treatment guidelines. So why is there such a disparity? Why do you have such a low number of people who are getting treatment? And that's what we set out to look for. So the first thing we did as a working group was break down what the steps are. What do you need to do in order to get successfully treated? So first thing is you have to be diagnosed as having chronic hepatitis B infection. You have to then be able to access appropriate ongoing care. And then you have to be identified as meeting the treatment guidelines. And fourth, you finally have to get your prescription, fill your prescription, take your prescription. So those are the four major steps. And we wanted to look at what the barriers were at each step and what the data were telling us in terms of the numbers at each step. So we created a little pyramid, and this is the top. The 2 million is the top of the pyramid. You know, looking at prevalence of chronic hep B infection in the U.S., you see a lot of different numbers out there. The CDC estimates that there are about 1.4 million chronic infections in the U.S. However, we know that that number is based on NHANES and some Sentinel County data that really don't accurately look at the number of infections. And a couple of other studies have looked at the truer prevalence, and we feel like it really is closer to 2 million individuals. So 2 million is the number we go with, and it's the number I like better. So looking at the number of undiagnosed, the people who have undiagnosed chronic hepatitis B infection, well, we don't really know what the self-awareness rate is in the U.S. We do know that there have been studies published in some of the high-risk populations in the U.S., and estimates of self-awareness of infection range anywhere from about 8%, which was in Philadelphia, to about 60% in other populations. So it varies a lot, but in general, self-awareness of infection tends to be low. There are a number of reasons. Number one, you know most of these, hepatitis B is a silent disease. It tends to be stigmatized. There's low awareness. There is misinformation, both on the provider part and on the community part in the high-risk populations. So people tend not to be screened and not to be self-aware of their infection. And really what we found looking at all of the studies is that probably the diagnosis rate in the U.S. is probably closest to about 30%. So big picture. So if you have if you have the top part of the pyramid, you have 2 million people who are infected. Only about 600,000 are self-aware, have actually been diagnosed with hepatitis B infection. And then about 500,000 of that total are eligible for treatment, which is about 25%. Then you go to the next step, people who are diagnosed but actually never make it into care. And this is another place where there are a lot of barriers. What we know is that most of the time, people are not getting into care when they're diagnosed with hepatitis B. Published studies show that, and unpublished data from the CDC indicate that people who are screened at hospitals or at targeted screening efforts have a better chance of getting into care, about 66% of them. But when you walk into like community clinics and medical offices, only about 40% are actually currently referred. And that 40%, that is unpublished data from the CDC that Scott Holmberg worked on. So if you have 600,000 diagnosed and only 50% approximately are accessing care, then you're getting about 300,000. So you started at 2 million, and you can see we're sort of whittling our way down to 50,000, and you can start seeing where the biggest gaps are. So then you have those who are diagnosed and actually make it into care, but they're not getting treatment. Again, like we said, only about 25% of people, it's estimated that about 25% of people at any given time really qualify based upon the current treatment guidelines, but what we know is that significantly fewer than 25% right now are getting treatment. Recently, the CDC had the CHECK study, the Chronic Hepatitis Cohort Study, showed that only 15% of HMO-sponsored patients in 2008 received antiviral drugs, which is much lower than what you would expect. So again, the big picture here is if you have 300,000 infected individuals enter into care, you would expect that about 75,000 are eligible for treatment, but only 50,000 prescriptions are written. So, you know, you start with your huge number, and we actually have whittled it down now to 50,000. And you can see, there are three major barriers. Number one is diagnosis, number two is access to care, and then number three is getting the treatment. And of the three, getting the treatment once you're in care is the smallest gap, actually. What we found is that once a person makes it into care, there's a good likelihood that they're going to appropriately get treatment. Not perfect, obviously, but a good likelihood. The biggest barriers, and this is not terribly new, but it's more documentation that show that the biggest barriers remain with undiagnosis and access to care. And this is just another way of looking at it for people who don't like pyramids. This shows the basically the gradient, and it looks at it from two perspectives. I know that a lot of people still use the CDC number of 1.4 million, so we showed it from the low prevalence, which is the blue, and the high prevalence, which is the yellowish beige. And it shows the number of chronic infections all the way down to the number of prescriptions. And again, look at that huge gap in self-awareness. That's where you see the biggest jump, people who just aren't diagnosed. So what are some of the barriers to diagnosis and care? Well, actually, there's a lot of literature out there looking at what some of the barriers are, and I put together a little model here, and it looks at the barriers from three different perspectives. You're looking at individual and personal barriers, provider-related barriers, and then your social and structural barriers. And you know, people talk about them a lot, but actually, I don't know, I actually did this recently, I wrote a paper on this, and there were over 40 or 50 published articles out there looking at these. And so at this point, it's not conjecture. This is actual, you know, these are data. This is stuff that has been published and written there. So in terms of personal barriers, lack of knowledge or misinformation, cultural beliefs regarding physician usage, potentially only going to physician when you don't feel well, and then fear of stigma and discrimination, which is something that, you know, we thought was a problem, but it actually is documented that people don't necessarily want to know they have chronic hepatitis B infection because they're afraid of what some of the outcomes will be. And then also fear of what potential side effects might come from long-term treatment. In terms of social and structural barriers, obviously lack of access to healthcare and lack of insurance. However, and this is something we found in Philadelphia, difficulty navigating the U.S. healthcare system was the number one reason that people who were diagnosed with hepatitis B didn't go to a doctor. Actually, health insurance and financial, even in the API immigrant population, was number three. So not inability to navigate. People just don't know where to go or who to go, who to see if they have chronic hepatitis B infection. And then obviously limited English proficiency, immigration status might, or also potential structural barriers. And then, and you've heard the first two speakers today talk about what some of the provider-related barriers are. Lack of knowledge related to screening, how to screen, who to screen, and how to follow up. And this is something we hear about all the time at the Hepatitis B Foundation from patients who call us up with blood tests and they say, well, this is what my blood test said. And it says, you know, surface antigen positive. My doctor told me this. There's nothing I can do, so not to worry about it. But should I worry about it? So, you know, this is the kind of thing we hear all the time. And then we know up here that there are screening guidelines out there. The CDC has published screening guidelines in 2008 that really outlines how to screen and who to screen. The question is, are they disseminated to the providers in the U.S. and are they being used? And that's something that I know the CDC would like to look at. I think that the more those were disseminated and used, the more you might see some screening. So what can we do from here? Well, we need more research and we need more interventions. We need to figure out a way to reduce the barriers and improve access to care. I think at this point, you know, we know what the barriers are. We need to figure out how to get past them. Public awareness and education campaigns like the ones we talked about today, those are really important, especially the ones that can target healthcare providers as well. And then I think also development of new therapies, and that's the one thing that we didn't necessarily talk about a lot, but right now you only have 25% of people who qualify for current treatment guidelines. They have to have a certain amount of active disease, they have to have a certain kind of family history, and also they have to show that they will respond to the treatment potentially. And so that leaves 75% of people who have chronic hepatitis B who still are at high risk for long-term negative outcomes, but there's nothing for them. So we need development of new kinds of therapies that can target those candidates. So in conclusion, very few people are actually being screened, entering into care, and receiving treatment. And so one of the things we found while we were doing this study is that there's very limited data out there. It was really hard for us to find numbers that estimated how many people qualify for treatment. There were only two or three studies out there, and so more data obviously would be better for us. We know that treatment is cost-effective. We know that it saves lives. And so I think the idea is let's do something about it in terms of research and intervention for the future and figure out not only a way to improve awareness and get people screened, but to make sure that that process is then followed up, make sure people actually get the care and treatment that they need. And I just wanted, so this was the working group. And it was great because we had people from all around the country and we had the CDC represented, which was really important to us because a lot of the data came from them and it's sort of sanctioned by the CDC, which is a big deal for us because it means that people will take our numbers more seriously. So thank you.